This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Barb Dallinger says she was considered the mom of her Illinois State University dorm floor until someone found out she was gay.
Six of the girls on the floor jumped me, and they tied me to the desk chair in the center of the room and gagged me so I couldn't, like, get anybody's attention or anything.
Things are better, but Dallinger says discrimination still happens. Plus, there's a new not-for-profit in town dedicated to getting women ready for apprenticeship programs and jobs that give them a sustainable wage. Katie Seelinger has more, and John Norton has the music of Lauren Jenkins. That and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots and the dawn of the gay rights movement in the U.S. The surprising thing for many gay young adults today is how recently things were really bad in discrimination against the LGBTQ plus community, and in some cases, still are. Barb Dallinger works at Illinois State University, but she says that as a student at ISU, she had a very rough start.
When I moved in, I really was the only girl on my floor whose mom sent them with the first aid kit. My mom packed the Tupperware bread box full of anything I would need the entire time that I was going to be here that semester. And the girls on the floor realized it, so they started coming to me and saying, you know, I need a Band-Aid, I need Pepto-Bismol, whatever. And I very quickly became kind of the mom on the floor, to the point that for my birthday, they sent me happy birthday mom cards. I came home one day and they had put this very complex wheel that moved that would tell them where I was, that I just had to move. It's like, you know, mom is in class, mom is practicing, mom is home for the weekend, whatever. And we really became a very close floor. And then I literally came home from class one afternoon and six of the girls on the floor jumped me and took me to my room, and they tied me to my desk chair in the center of the room and gagged me so I couldn't, like, get anybody's attention or anything, and left me in there. And then they locked the door, and then they put a sign on the door saying only one of her gay friends would come and let her out. One of the guys who lived above me noticed that I wasn't at dinner, and he came down to double check. But I wound up being in there about 4 hours.
What had happened, though? What made it change?
They somehow figured out that I was dating one of the other girls. And it led to this, honestly, year and a half long bit of, I had to take my showers at like 3 o'clock in the morning. Because if I didn't, they would throw SpaghettiOs and leftover food and oatmeal and stuff over the side into. I was still trying to wrap my head around it myself. I'd never had this happen to me before. So I'm trying to figure out if I even am gay. Can I even do this? So here I am trying to work all this out, and I'm walking through the dining center, and people are throwing food at me, and I'm going down to the front desk to get my mail, and they're mailing me packages full of trash and just crazy things.
It was that bad.
It seriously was. It seriously was that bad.
Would no adult help? Would no staff member help?
Because I hadn't figured it out yet. I wasn't out to my parents, so I wasn't telling my family anything. And quite frankly, the RA on my floor had called us to a meeting and said that she had had an abortion over the summer. She was in a really rough place, and we all just needed to deal with it.
Not helpful.
Yeah, so not
I mean, I feel for
all.
Her, but not
yeah,
helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we let her alone. But then the other piece that adds to that is that transfer piece, because I hadn't gone through preview. I hadn't done any of that. So when I walked in, and since she didn't tell us, I knew that there were names at the front desk that had initials after them, but I didn't know what they meant. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know where they were. I knew that the desk was someplace you went if you got a package, but that was about it. Otherwise, you went to your mail slot. But I didn't see it as a means of support.
So you didn't seek out support. How did you cope with it alone?
Honestly didn't. Just kind of sucked it up and got through. The main thing that I did have that I will always be very grateful for, I was a member of the Big Red Marching Machine. And the College of Fine Arts really took me in. They didn't know why, but they took me in. And I knew that when I was on that football field, that the people who were harassing me wouldn't come that far. They wouldn't approach me on the football field. I knew in my heart that Dr. Livingston and Kevin Jensen was my drum major. I knew Kevin wouldn't let anybody do anything to me. I was safe on that football field. I was reasonably safe in the College of Fine Arts. I was okay in the practice rooms. So I stayed there. They were truly a life-saving department.
What happened with the atmosphere on the floor? The mom thing was probably over.
Gone. Completely gone. Completely gone. It just became something that I got through because I was going to be student teaching, so I knew I didn't, there was an end in sight. It's like, I'm just going to do this until I go student teach. And that's what I did. You just do what you have to do.
When the girls jumped you in your room, what did you do? What did you say to them?
I was so surprised. I thought they were kidding around, honestly. It's like, these are girls that I'm attached to, that I've been holding your hair back while you throw up in the bathroom, And I was stunned. I didn't believe them at first. And there were also several of them were, like, but not on the team, but basketball players. So they were tall and larger than me. And, they picked me up and carried me in there.
Did this shape your attitude toward other people for some time? It
shoved me back in the closet, which I wasn't even out. I maybe had a little toe out, but it caused me to just get slammed right back in.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Barb Dallinger as we approach the anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. So you graduate. You get a teaching degree. You go off and start that career. What happened in that career?
I moved with my girlfriend. She got offered a job in St. Louis, and we moved to St. Louis, and I got a teaching job down there as a kindergarten teacher. We were very closeted. What that had really done was scare us enough to really keep us closeted and not interact with a lot of other people, especially when we moved and didn't really trust anybody. We had no gay friends down there, and just out of the blue, I'm teaching. And I'm a good kindergarten teacher. I seriously am. And once you see me do presentations on campus, it all becomes clear. It's like there are a lot of carryovers, exactly. But I got the award in the district for the outstanding teacher on a Wednesday night at our spring banquet. And I came to work on Friday morning, and my direct supervisor told me that she needed to talk to me at the end of the day. And I was like, oh, okay, once the kids are gone, okay. And, I had your standard kindergarten classroom. I had a hamster. We were trying to hatch eggs, in our little incubator, stories, books, mm-hmm. little kitchen. And she asked me, she said, one of the parents has complained. They said that they saw you and the other kindergarten teacher out having dinner the other night. And I was like, well, I don't know Kristen that well. We weren't out having dinner, but we eat. So if we did, was that really a bad thing? And she said, well, this parent was under the impression that you and Kristen looked like you were in a relationship together, and that basically that you and Kristen have been having an affair during your time here at the school. And I told her, I was like, no, I'm not having an affair with Kristen. She's nice and all that, but no. And she's like, oh, thank heaven. I am so glad that I'm so grateful that you aren't gay.
And you said,
and stupid me, going for the honesty points, said, oh, I'm not telling you I'm not gay. I've been with the same woman for 12 years now. I'm telling you I'm not having an affair with Kristen. And she said, I wish you hadn't told me that, because now I have to fire you.
Ugh.
And it was just like, what? She's like, you're one of our best teachers, and I have to fire you. And, I mean, that just totally sent me into this downward spiral for about 3 months, in all honesty, about 3 months. I was just depressed. Once again, still not out to the parents, can't tell anybody, can't tell people why I got fired, why I'm not working. But to make it even worse, when they did that, they put signs on the school, on the doors, saying that I was not allowed on the school grounds. I was not allowed to talk to the students. I was no longer employed there. If they saw me out in the community, to not let their children, to not let me come talk to their children.
What year was this?
It was 1988, I believe.
A lot of people would just, their faith in human nature would be shot after that. Yours, it doesn't appear to be.
I was getting angry. I was getting angry, I'll admit. And then I talked to somebody about it, like legal counsel, and they're like, you know, you can fight this, but A, you will be on the front page of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch every day for probably 3 years. You know, you are going to be the court case because the laws in Missouri were still in effect.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically illegal to be gay in Missouri.
And
when you walked into a gay bar, you literally saw signs that said, by entering this establishment, you are violating civic code, blah, 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 and that you're aware of it.
And you chose not to do that?
Yep. I
Why?
Chose not to do that because, A, I wasn't out to my parents or my family. My girlfriend wasn't out to her family. We really weren't out to a lot of our friends even. I was a much different person. My mother raised me to be a happy little housewife. I love to cook. I love to do laundry. I love to clean. I just didn't cooperate on the whole having a husband thing. A happy little housewife, and it just wasn't in my nature.
So you came back to ISU.
I did. I came back to Bloomington.
Why ISU after you had had such a negative experience at ISU?
They offered me the job first. I applied at multiple places around town just to get a job. One of my friends was an ISU cop. And she's like, you really should come back and work at Illinois State. It's a great place to work. And I was just like, really? Really? Because that worked so well for me last time. And she's like, give it a try. And I did. And they called me right away. It was a totally different experience. I was in the College of Fine Arts. Then I transferred to a job out with Campus Dining. It was Residence Hall Food Service at the time. Got me into student affairs, then went into housing, and then as a total coincidence, I applied for a job at the Bone in 1997 and have been basically part of the Bone Student Center, student affairs, dean of students ever since.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Barb Dellinger is telling us her story on this week of the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. You have since become a part of the Human Library, telling
this story.
You are an advisor to the Campus Pride organization.
I used to be. I'm more of a friend to them now.
You're still involved with them, though.
Very, very involved. Yeah, they're under diversity advocacy now.
Mm-hmm. How important was it for you to do those things since you were so reticent about going public and fighting the discrimination that you encountered earlier in life?
When I moved back to Bloomington Normal, I had a pride sticker on my back window of my car. And around 1991, 92. I was driving my car. Honestly, it was down West MacArthur. And somebody shot the windows out of my car, out of my back window while I was driving. To the point we had a duck. And they found, obviously, my back window crumbled. There were shell casings in the window and stuff. And I contacted the police. And what they told me was, what did you expect with that rainbow sticker in your back window? And it was just like, okay. And that is when I met Dave Bentlin and got involved in the Advocacy Council for Human Rights. Then I started getting more involved with that, and I truly got to this point of, because I was very quiet. I was really a very quiet person. I got to this point, it's like, you've taken away the livelihood that I ever wanted to do with my entire life. You took away my teaching license. You put me through hell during college. And it doesn't look like it's going to get any better. And now I'm mad. Now I'm mad. And I made the connection when I went to housing. When I moved into housing, I worked under Maureen Blair. And I spent a lot of time talking to her about things. And I told her, I said, I really want to do this. I said, my mission is going to be to make sure that what happened to me does not happen to the Redbirds of today. The transfers need to be able to know where they're supposed to go. The gay kids need somebody to call. And I literally, I was sitting in my little cubicle in housing, and one of my former Pride students walked up to my little cubicle and knocked on the door. She was here for preview. And said, they told me you're nice to the gay kids. I was like, yes, I am. Come on in. And that just, she honestly helped open the door to, I know this is what I'm supposed to do. I know this is not what I'm supposed to do.
All these stories are not that long ago.
No, that's the thing people don't realize. Yeah. They think this was happening a long, long time ago. I'm a part of the board that administers the LGBT support fund that we offer for emergency crisis situations. We got a letter and a call and awarded one yesterday. This is our fourth one in the spring semester and now this summer. These are students whose parents have literally, they've come out to their parents and they have literally cut them off and said, you're getting nothing from me. I never want to see you again. And on top of losing that relationship, they're also losing their livelihood. All of a sudden, they have no place to go. I mean, one student, he got kicked out of his home. They took his car. He didn't know where to go. I got a call. It's been several years ago. I got a call 10:30 at night. One of my Pride students called me and said that his father had just thrown him out of the second-story window of their house. And he was hurt. And what do I do? Where are you at? I'm on my way. Stay right there.
This was Bloomington Normal?
Yes. I'm on my way. One student in particular, his dad just went ballistic, told him to change his name. I mean, the works. It's insane. Now, a lot of these parents, some of them, we have some success stories. Some have come around. They honestly have. The thing that I always tell the students when they're talking to me about coming out, A, don't come out until you're ready to accept the consequences, no matter how it goes. The people that I thought would be so against me were very supportive. And several of the people that I was positive were going to be supportive cut me out of their life.
So you can't tell.
You can't tell. You just can't tell.
Even today, you can't tell.
Even today, it's like, and don't do it until you're ready to accept whatever happens either way.
This is somewhat less optimistic than I thought this conversation would be, given the state of Illinois' protections and gay marriage, and given the way that Bloomington and Normal have changed ordinances over the years, mm-hmm. and given not in our town, and all of these things that have moved the community towards social justice, that this is still common.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely, I don't want to apply it's not better. It's definitely better. When I took over advising the Pride organization in, it was 1995, I think. When I took over the Pride organization in 95, it was very much a coming out organization. The students didn't know where to go. They thought they might be gay. And they would tell me stories of walking past the room for 3 weeks to try and get the courage up to come inside. And to find a place where they were welcome. Sometimes they just want, like, they'd step out of my office. That guy in chemistry that you've been waiting for weeks to ask you out finally did, and you want to tell somebody. You just want to tell somebody, and you can't call your mom. I say, you just want to tell somebody when something good happens. So I try to be there for them. Now, Pride has evolved into very much, it is very social, but also activity-based and political. The students are coming in not, I think I might be gay, But I was president of the Gay Straight Alliance in my junior high or my high school. And what am I going to do here? Which is amazing to see. It's amazing for me to see the difference in them. Their friends are so supportive. Their friends are so supportive. And their parents are getting better. The thing I always tell them is, like, you have to remember, if you were coming out to me, you're coming out to your grandma. And me coming out to my mom was you coming out to your great-grandma. Think how different that would have been.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Barb Dallinger is our guest, talking about discrimination against LGBTQ plus people. I mean, a lot of the students today have never heard of Stonewall.
They haven't.
And why is it important to mark this 50th anniversary when things are better but not great?
I think it's somehow they have to know what has happened. You learn from your history. I was so upset when the loss of Matthew Shepard for the 10th anniversary. I went to the Pride group and I said, okay, it's the 10th year for Matthew Shepard. What are we going to do? And they looked at me and said, well, we don't know who that is. And it was like, we have failed you.
Yeah, Matthew Shepard was the person tied to a fence row in Laramie, Wyoming.
Yeah.
And left there in adverse weather conditions until he was no longer able to survive.
If we don't teach them, they're never going to know. If no one taught us about the Revolutionary War, we wouldn't know about all those people. Hamilton would not have been the hit it is today. We would not have known about those people unless you tell them. And what they haven't been told, they have not been told the whole story of things that happened. Harvey Milk, I mean, phenomenal.
San Francisco Board of Supervisors, gay activist, murdered because of his sexual orientation.
And the guy got away with it. I mean, he really did. And it takes some of those things to get that outcry, to get that presence. That's like with Stonewall. You get to a point, and I was the same way. You get to a point, and you're like, okay, I'm done. And they were done. We've had things happen here. We've had students attacked and beat up on the quad in the evenings and things. One of the saddest things, I swear, that happened to me, one of my students, he was attacked under the underpass. He was riding his bike from West Campus his first night here during Welcome Week, his first night here. He was attacked under that underpass. He wound up coming to a Pride meeting. Didn't say anything to us about it, became very involved, was an officer for 3 years, very close to me because you're an officer and you spend so much time together, and he never told me. And one of the jobs I have been through is being in charge of commencement, and I was working commencement at his commencement. And he came up to me, and he said, he's in his cap and gown, and he's literally getting ready to cross the stage. And I hugged him. It's like, oh, I'm going to miss you so much. And he said, I have to tell you something. And he told me about being attacked on the underpass his first night here. He told me, I didn't tell you at first because I was afraid. I didn't tell you as time went on because I cared so much I knew it would hurt you. And I didn't want to hurt you that way. But now I know I can't leave without at least telling you that it happened. Broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not telling me, what else is happening out there? What's happening to the students that I don't know aren't coming to me?
He's denying himself the support that he knew would be there.
Exactly. Exactly. He was getting it in his own way because he was involved with this. But he wasn't being totally open and totally open to himself.
When will that fear end?
I think it's getting there. I think that we really need to consciously work at turning some of the things around, because we hadn't had anyone for about 3 years. We had had no requests for funding, for the emergency funding. And our committee met. We're like, woohoo, we're done. Everything's great.
Nope.
And we were checking into what can we do with this money? Can we offer programming? Can we bring in a speaker? And then wham, about 2.5 years ago, things started turning around. We get at least 3 or 4 semester now.
Because of?
I think there's a different climate happening right now in the country. I think Now, I have always stressed to the students, the environment on campus is very different. Walking to class holding your partner's hand is different than walking down Main Street in downtown Bloomington. You have to watch your surroundings, and you have to be careful.
Barb Dallinger, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for asking.
A History Out of the Closet event looking at the climate for LGBTQ plus people in Bloomington Normal takes place from 5:30 to 7:30 tomorrow at the McLean County Museum of History.
Support for GLT comes from Monkey Duck Marina, just a little beyond normal on Lake Bloomington, offering pontoon, bass boat, canoe, and kayak rentals for sport, leisure, or fishing. Services include concessions, bait, and propane. Details at monkeyduckmarina.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the music of Lauren Jenkins with John Norton. A new nonprofit organization in Bloomington Normal is targeting the wage gap between men and women. It's called Dreams Are Possible and is the brainchild of retired ISU social work professor and Heartland Community College board member Mary Campbell. GLT's Katie Seelinger talks with Campbell about the possibilities and goals of this new venture to offer training for women to gain sustainable wage jobs.
Essentially, it means in a laboratory, actually using tools that will be the same tools that they might use as a construction worker or a sheet metal worker, or and we'll need to go beyond our building, but for forklift driving and those things, all the skills that are we've traditionally called sort of the male fields, those are where the money is for women. We just need to be the transition that helps them get there.
How long does education or an apprenticeship usually last?
Well, our role is to get them ready to take the apprenticeship test. In order to take an apprenticeship test to get into the union, you have to be familiar with about 100 tools, which in general most women are not. So our goal is to expose them to the tools of the trade and help them be comfortable with them, recognize them, know what they are for, use them in a laboratory setting, and then be able to then transition into an apprenticeship test and pass it. Apprenticeships with the unions can be a couple of years long, but they are paid apprenticeships. So the money that they will earn during those apprenticeships is probably a lot better than what they're earning currently.
How much does educating these women cost? Do these women have to pay for their own education?
In terms of the Dreams Are Possible project, no, it's a 501c3 not-for-profit, and the services are provided free. So our goal will be to have this facility, which is under construction right now, hopefully will be up and running by the end of the summer. And that area is where the women can come, no cost, express what their interests are, and then we will try to arrange opportunities for them. Most of the people that we will serve will have completed high school or got a GED or something along that line. So we want to network with Heartland Community College. I'm on the board of trustees there, and they have an amazing ready-to-work program. So if we have women who want to go into the vet tech programs, for example, who want to be exposed to phlebotomy, those are areas where we will transition them over to the Heartland Community College campus. We want to be the transition. We want to bring classes from Heartland Community College out to our building on the west, on West Olive Street. We want to then transition the women over to Heartland Community College ready-to-work programs. So that will expose them to a wider range than just the building trades.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Katie Seelinger. We're talking with Mary Campbell about Dreams Are Possible, a new program to offer training to help women get gender wage equivalency and economically sustainable jobs in Bloomington Normal. Unions have apprenticeships and education programs, and women are eligible for them. Heartland Community College has such programs as well. What's the gap you are filling with this center?
We're filling the gap that's partly cultural. Most women who didn't do well in school, even most women in general, are not familiar with the building trades. They didn't grow up using tools. They didn't help their family member fix a car or build a house. Whereas men tend to be able to enter those fields easier because they've had much more tool exposure. So our gap is to sort of bridge that cultural thing, help women understand that there are jobs out there. Every woman, you and I, we could be forklift drivers. You drive around town, you'll see signs all over the place for forklift drivers. It's a good wage. We sort of see ourselves as a bridge, a transition. We can't do it all. We're just one building on West Olive Street where we'll have opportunities for the women to learn. We'll have a place for their kids to play while the women are in class if they need that. We'll have job coaching. We'll have computers for learning basic math skills, because all of those fields require basic math. But we're just a connection. We see ourselves as a point in time that we can get them to their next point.
How does this opportunity provide economic growth in Bloomington Normal?
Tremendously. We have a very high proportion of people who are below the poverty line, so that those individuals have difficulty finding housing that's decent. They have difficulty providing for their children, paying for their groceries, all those other things. So if we can provide opportunities for women to go from an $18,000 a year to part-time jobs at minimum wage and move them into a full-time position that's a career that's at $35,000 a year, that money then makes its way back into the community. And all the studies indicate that if you invest in women, those women invest in their children. That's the way it works worldwide. So if we invest in these women, they're going to invest in their kids. We're going to have better kids, more ready to learn at school, not worried about what life is like at home, not worried about whether they're going to be evicted. That's going to be a better situation for children. So it's kind of a win-win for everybody.
According to the Institute of Women's Policy Research, in the 2018 census, a white woman made 81 cents to every dollar made by a white man. African-American woman made 65 cents, and Latina woman made even less. Mm-hmm. Disabled woman, woman of color, and openly LGBTQ plus woman are less likely to be hired and more likely to face workplace discrimination. Are there efforts to combat workplace discrimination and encourage intersectionality in this organization?
In our design, we want to make sure that the women realize that the world that they're going to enter, which, as I said, is predominantly male-dominated, and the women have to know how to handle working and still maintaining their dignity in an environment like that. So that'll be a lot of the emphasis on preparing the women for that world. One of the things we did with another project, Labyrinth Outreach Services to Women, was we had women come in. Now, they didn't have any hands-on tool experience in that project, but we actually had women come in from electricians and plumbers and people who were in the male-dominated fields and talk with those women about the difficulties they will face, but the opportunities that provided. The reality is that when men go into fields, and sometimes women in careers, they get a mentor. So that's going to be one of our pushes. The building trades, for example, desperately need women. They don't have in any way an equal representation. It's primarily still male. And so nationally, they are public about the fact that they want to recruit women. So what we have to do is partner with them and help them understand that they also have to provide mentors and a healthier work environment for those women while they're there. So that's all part of sort of a culture shift that we're going to be working on as we also are working to train the women.
What constitutes a living wage in Bloomington Normal?
Yeah, it certainly depends on the size of your family, but $18,000 is below the poverty line, so if you had a family of two or three kids, you'd probably need to have double that, or at least in the high 20s. So some of the fields will start you out. But when you start out in these fields where there is guaranteed increments as you improve, you're looking to be into the mid-30s to high 30s. The opportunity is in some ways expansive, and the more we find out about the different fields, the more likelihood it is we will be able to have that culture shift for the women.
How does this opportunity make Bloomington Normal stronger and more united?
Well, in so many ways. If you have a community where you have a high number of people, especially parents, who are living in poverty, you have situations where the parent isn't able to go to their child's activities. The parent isn't able to be there at parent-teacher meetings. There are just a lot of ways, just starting from the beginning, where a parent who has a full-time job that pays a living wage, I know a woman who works 3 part-time jobs to take care of 2 children. She can't be there for any of those things because of the hours that conflict. She barely gets to sleep. So it deprives our next generation of children the opportunity to have an engaged parent. We want to make sure that that happens. Our community is healthier as a result. Certainly economically we're healthier. Certainly we have a greater ability to purchase items when we have a better income. And we have a happier community.
What other local organizations are contributing to this project?
Right now, it's a standalone 501c3, and we're beginning the process of doing some significant fundraising. We're involved with a group right now called Youth Global Citizens, and they're a group of high school kids who go through a program that's similar to the Multicultural Leadership Program. They learn about service learning, and those kids are working to build sort of a awareness campaign, a fundraiser at Jason's Deli, and they want to develop a way to have a mural on the side of our old grocery store building, which I think will be amazing. On June 27th, we're partnering with Home Depot, which they have a grant that they do for local programs. They provide resources, financial resources, to help with the purchase of the materials, but they also provide an opportunity for their employees to get involved in giving back to their communities. So we don't know exactly how many will show up on the 27th. They are talking about 40 to 50. We have flooring to install. They are providing much of the resources for us to purchase that flooring. This building was an old grocery store back in the 1920s, owned by Mr. A.G. Erickson. And so it's been empty for a while. That's why we were able to afford to buy it. And we're also partnering with the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation because they're the ones who we're under their umbrella as a 501c3. So we're in the process now of continuing. We have a board of directors that is working to raise awareness. We have a Facebook page that was, again, this is all volunteers. Everything that we've done so far is volunteers and local donations. We have 2 individuals from the Bricklayers Union, and they have been working for 4 days now on restoring parts of the brick building that had been badly damaged. So they have transformed the back end of the building and made it a lot safer. So we'll continue to partner with organizations like that and with other building trades as we move forward.
That perfectly leads into my next question, which is how much work does the building need?
Well, it wasn't condemned. But it was close, in my opinion. We've had to shore up all of the beams in the basement for the infrastructure. We had to replace all of the floor beams in the side building, which is on a crawl space. So now we're rebuilding the floors, all new walls, all new heating and air conditioning, all new plumbing and electrical. So we have to meet the city codes for a commercial building. It had not been in compliance, I'm sure, for decades. So we're meeting with all of the things that the city has set forth, an ADA bathroom, et cetera. All of those things are being constructed. We're the tear out. We partnered with Youth Build of McLean County. They came in and helped us to do a lot of demolition of the old walls. So we're in the rebuild phase. And after Home Depot comes on the 27th, the building will look a lot better. So it's really a massive undertaking. Oh, new windows, I mean, new doors. The structure's still there. But other than that, it's pretty much all new stuff.
Mary Campbell is the co-creator of Dreams Are Possible, one of Bloomington Normal's newest not-for-profits. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm Katie Seelinger.
Dreams Are Possible is expected to open towards the end of this summer on 1311 West Olive in Bloomington.
When Amy Webb turned 30, she decided to find her true love on an online dating site. And to do it right, she hacked the algorithm to to find the perfect man.
And as it turns out, I was the most popular person online.
Stories of how we love. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Big machine label artist Lauren Jenkins has a background in acting and film directing. She used that to produce a video short to go with three traditional music videos out of her new album. Jenkins speaks with GLT's John Norton via Skype about her Americana Country hybrid album, No Saint, and the film short. Jenkins says she had to tactfully convince her reluctant record company the 11-minute film was worthwhile. Making the three traditional videos first helped her sell the idea when executives realized there was a larger story to be told.
And I was like, yeah, there is. Here's the script. Let me go back to New Mexico and make the short film.
From a marketing perspective, what do you get from making that film short as opposed to the other three more traditional music videos that you were alluding to?
The three-part music video series to me didn't tell the complete story. From a storytelling standpoint, it was important for me to have the short film component. This is my first short film that I've been able to have complete control over. Most of the time, anytime I've been working on a film, it's somebody else's. So this was my vision. I just really felt like I had to make it and was going to, whether the label signed off on it or not. But from a marketing standpoint, it's pretty intense and pretty involved. And then also it's allowed us to submit to film festivals and have screenings. And it's just a model that if the story is there, it's something that I would like to pursue throughout my career.
I need to figure out a way to sort it all out. Every time I try to sit down and frame one thing as the middle or the beginning, what I'm left with are all these moments. I don't know how to sort them out anymore.
Well, habits are a bitch to break, and hearts just wanna
all right, the snippet is from Running Out of Road. It's the film short by Lauren Jenkins, our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. Her brand new album is called No Saint. I want to get to that in just a second here, Lauren, but there's a lot of pain in this video short, as well as, I guess, in the album itself. How biographical is the short itself?
The short film is a combination of my story, and then I took a little bit of creative liberty to create these characters, and I'm not going to tell you which parts are autobiographical.
Well, let's go to the song itself called Running Out of Road from the album No Saint. I want to play a little bit of this song. What's with the title, Running Out of Road?
Well, I often feel like I am. It's kind of ironic because I haven't. I mean, sometimes I have to create my own road by going off into the dirt path somewhere. And that's kind of why I love that guitar intro, because the juxtaposition between the lyrics and also the feeling of the music, where you get this sense of kind of hope, which I really love, because that's sort of life for me right now. It's kind of, I'm always on the road, and sometimes I feel like I'm hitting dead ends, but there always seems to be more road, even if it feels like there's not. Running out of road.
You were unusually driven and even maybe entrepreneurial at a very young age. What do you remember about that time? We're talking, what, 7, 8 years old. Didn't you declare to your parents that you either wanted to be an actor or a musician?
Yeah, I think about 8 or 9 is when it really kicked in. I was burning to start, you know, telling stories and playing music and working in film and learning photography, school was tough for me. So 15 was when I was finally able to start hitting the highway.
From my understanding is you were writing and even performing music at a very young age, but you also evolved into acting and modeling. Why the turn now into music with this new album?
Well, all of it was happening at the same time, but just on different levels. So I was working on film sets behind the camera and in front of the camera before I was professionally, quote unquote, doing music. And it just sort of happened that way. I didn't have anybody tell me that you could make a career in music, and I didn't really understand how that would even work. So I was playing music when I was 15, but it was, you know, for tips at coffee shops and trying to find clubs that would book this random 15-year-old who writes songs by herself. So it was just a different level. But I've always been a storyteller, and they've kind of happened at the same time since I was young. And I sort of put it all in the same box.
For the sweetest of sweet dreams.
Song is Giving Up the Ghost, the new album No Saint by our guest Lauren Jenkins. Now this song, Lauren, not only haunting, but it's beautiful in a way in how it captures a lover wrestling with their past and how it's haunting the storyteller today, both at the same time. And I think you capture that very well on both ends.
Thank you. I was proud of that one. I wrote it with my friend Emily Shackleton. I found myself in a love triangle with my lover at the time and his past relationship. It was really important to me that song, that there wasn't any sort of like blame or anger, because, you know, we all have a past, but it just kind of sucks when the person you're with has one that won't go away.
Lauren Jenkins, you are on Big Machine Records. That's a major record label. How did you get signed to a label?
Very waywardly. I started going to Nashville when I was about 15, 16, and then started working with a songwriter and producer when I was around 18 or 19. When I was living in New York around 21 and 22, he just asked if he could send my music to labels. And I was like, sure, knock yourself out. And at that time, I was self-producing an EP. And next thing you know, I'm on a flight from New York, meeting with labels, and then signed a contract with Big Machine pretty shortly after.
You know, we've had a lot of discussions on WGLT about the pros and cons of being on a major record label. There's some prominent industry people that see it as a positive with the usual record label issues. Others see it as really limiting. What is your experience? I guess limited experience at this point, but what is your experience being on a major record label?
I think for anybody that wants to get a major label deal, I think I would say that you don't have to. It definitely has pros and cons, but I think it's different for everybody. I can't really picture what my path would be like had I not decided to sign with Big Machine. They've been very gracious about being patient and letting me follow my crazy ideas, even though I don't really follow the rules. At the end of the day, I know that I would be doing music and telling stories and making films with or without the support of a label. So I think it's a positive for me that I have the support of a label.
Interesting. Okay. I want to finish the interview here with the song Blood.
Dying's no way to prove we're not the same. The blood in
Blood is the final song on the album, and another difficult song, right? Both, well, lyrically anyway, dealing with drugs and alcohol and the effects of that. Mm-hmm. I guess overall on the album, there's a lot of pain on here. Did you feel like you were exercising demons doing this album and you came out better on the other side?
I mean, I think anytime that you talk honestly about life, about your life or life as you see it, that there's healing in that. So there's definitely some chapters on this album where there was some pain. And I think that it's, for me, it's super healing to talk about it. But Blood in particular was a song about somebody very close to me that was going through a really tough time. And I didn't know how to help this person. So I wrote that song hoping that it would break through or help in some way. And whether it did or didn't, you hope as a songwriter that music can help somebody else, especially if you're coming from an honest place.
Well, Lauren Jenkins, congrats on a debut album. This is fantastic, and thanks for taking time to talk with us about it.
Thank you so much.
Country Americana artist Lauren Jenkins speaking with GLT's John Norton. Jenkins opens for Wild Feathers tomorrow night at the Castle Theater in Bloomington. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. And that's also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton and Katie Seelinger. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.